Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. So here's the good news. The overall rate of stroke in the U.S. is decreasing. However, some 800,000 Americans experience a stroke each year, and stroke is the nation's fifth leading cause of death. Strokes are also striking younger and middle-aged people more often. On today's program, we'll discuss stroke symptoms, causes, prevention, and treatment. Joining us in the studio today is Dr. Raymond Reichwein, an associate professor of neurology and co-director of the Stroke Center at the Penn State Hershey Medical Center. Dr. Reichwein, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Also joining us is Dr. Kevin Cockcroft, is a neurosurgeon at the Penn State College of Medicine and Hershey Medical Center, and also co-director of the Stroke Center. Dr. Cockcroft, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And up front, we have Lucy Nazo, a good friend of mine, who very often with her communications firm has suggested guests, great guests over the years to appear on the program. Lucy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Scott. Thanks for doing the show.
It's unusual to have you on that end of the microphone, but there is a reason.
There is.
Your mm-hmm. daughter, Lucy Alana, 26 years old, January of 2017, suffered a stroke. Tell me about Lucy Alana before January of 2017.
Sure. Well, our beautiful daughter, Lucy Alana, was like so many others. She had a wonderful life in terms of she was working, driving, friends, and also a mother to our beautiful grandson, Vincent. And you can imagine the shock that we were in, that we were told she had a stroke, came out of nowhere.
Her personality mm-hmm. and what kind of person was she before January 2017?
Sure. Well, Lucy's always been more on the quiet side at times, and yet other times, I mean, she was funny, fun-loving, but more quiet and introverted. And she, loves her son Vincent very much and very playful with him. And she has a very playful personality, I must say, which, you know, it's fun to see at that age. But she, you know, she really enjoyed life. And, it was just for us something that we never dreamed of, you know, last year in January.
So what happened?
So Lucy had been having some dental issues and not feeling well. And after a few days of that, she then, really wasn't feeling well, was violently ill, and as was at a friend's house. And an ambulance was called, which is what you want to do. And she was rushed to an ER. I met her at the ER, and she from there was really, really sick, convulsive syncope, as I call it, where she'd be in and out of consciousness, and her color was pasty. She wasn't walking or getting out of a wheelchair, and she had what she characterized as, or we did, as a rubber arm, so to speak. And then as things progressed, she had blurred vision. The room was spinning, a headache, and she just could not stop getting sick. And then she began flatlining, which was,
her heart stopped.
Her heart stopped, and more than once, which was so painful. And you're in disbelief. You're just in shock. All of this is occurring so quickly. And there's your daughter, who, for the most part, is healthy and just deteriorating in front of you. And I can't even describe in words what it's like. You feel helpless. You just want to help her.
26 years old. Mm-hmm. Did you suspect stroke? Did any of the medical professionals, the emergency personnel, anyone suspect a stroke?
They did not, but I did. I did ask. That was one thing that I asked. And as things progressed and went on, after hours, of course, hour after hour, and you just want help. You see your child slipping away in front of you, which you can never imagine happening, and you want answers. You want to take control. You want to save your child. So there were a lot of things going on, a lot of things being ruled out, which is part of medicine, of course, But again, we just knew something was terribly wrong, and I kept saying that. Something is terribly wrong. Like, she has never been this way, never gone through anything like this, and as more and more symptoms presented themselves, that was one of the very questions that I did ask.
You were the first to ask that.
I was.
And what was the answer?
There wasn't an answer. There were tests, of course, and then I will say that after about 24 hours, the stroke was finally diagnosed, but she had continued flatlining, which that's another key thing for anybody listening. You know, think of the pressure of her. She had this massive stroke and the pressure on that brain stem, which was impacting on her breathing and her heart rate. And that was so key. And that shouldn't be happening. That's not typical. And you need help immediately for something of that nature. So, of course, again, she was hanging on by a thread. And thankfully, we were able to get her to Penn State, Hershey, and they are our stroke heroes. I know you've heard me say that a lot this past year, and I can't thank Dr. Reckwine, who's with us today. He's one of our heroes, and they saved her life.
Well, when you say that, just to provide a little more information there, Penn State Hershey Medical Center is a comprehensive stroke center, and in a few minutes we're going to talk about what that means, because that is important. Not to downplay the roles that other medical facilities and hospitals play.
Certainly
because
not.
If someone is suffering a stroke, you want to get to the nearest hospital, call 911, get there as soon as you can. And we're going to talk about the importance of speed in just a few minutes. So what's the last year plus been like? I understand that Lucy Lana is now 28.
She is.
She just had a birthday. What's the last year plus been like for you and your husband, Paul, and the family?
Lucy's had a tough journey. She was hanging on to life by a thread. She had to undergo a brain craniectomy at Hershey Med Center. And then she also had a loop recorder that had to be implanted because heart arrhythmia and heart rate and, you know, are very key as well and can be another symptom. We really pushed her. She was very sick, and Hershey helps to really get them through that critical time. And then we really fought again to get her as an aggressive plan as possible put into place to be able to have her come back to her, fullest capability. So then from there, she went to the Penn State Hershey Rehabilitation Hospital. Another one of our stroke heroes went through occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, recreational therapy. Can't say enough about, you know, learning to walk, your balance, use your left side again, be able to do simple things like put your hair up, cut your food, your speech. I mean, her short-term memory is an issue. Cognitively, there is a big impact, sadly. But again, after that journey, then home health care, and that was done. We'd have sometimes 10 appointments a week between therapy coming in and medical appointments, and then after months of that, outpatient therapy again down at Hershey on an outpatient basis for all those areas to gain strength, gain mobility, and to help all of these functions come back to the greatest degree that they can, because that, you know, the time right after a stroke is so key. Those first few weeks, months, even the, you know, a year, and they've seen gains even after a year or two. And then we did additional outpatient therapy. And then there's the whole mental component of it. Because how often at 26 can somebody relate that you've had a stroke? Your friends can't. And your whole world changes. She's still not driving. She's still not back to work. And she's got a child, you know, our beautiful grandson. So life is why we're so blessed that she is where she is today, that she's got this great support network. Our family's been wonderful with her. Her medical team has been exceptional, and I can't say enough. And that's why I'm on a mission. I'm a mom on a mission. And I want folks to know, and at any age, stroke doesn't discriminate. It hit our 26-year-old daughter, and it's forever changed her life and ours. But there's so much you can do to prevent it. There's so much you can do if you're having a stroke to get that key treatment and care.
Let's talk about some of those things. Dr. Reckwine, probably what strikes many people about Lucy Alana's story is her age, mm-hmm. that she was 26 when this occurred. Most people probably picture someone who has suffered a stroke as an older person. Mm-hmm. Is that, obviously, it's becoming more normal just by the statistics I'm seeing, but why is it happening more often in younger people?
A great question, and some of it is the standard risk factors that used to occur in older individuals that caused cholesterol deposits like high blood pressure, diabetes, et cetera, now are starting to occur in younger people. The diets aren't as good. Their exercise patterns aren't as good. So some of it is just the older disease process has moved to younger individuals. The other thing is, as time has gone on, we've learned a lot of information about migraine with ARA, clotting disorders, birth control pills, and those are still prevalent out there and are associated with stroke in younger individuals, particularly women. There's also more recent evidence on certain medications, particularly anti-inflammatory medications, that they can increase stroke and cardiovascular risk. So some of it is common things are becoming more common, like migraine with ARA. There's a strong prevalence for birth control pill use out there. And then again, if you have pains and other conditions and you're using anti-inflammatory medications, it's a combination of factors that can lead to a stroke.
The birth control pill part of this is interesting because most often, at least my observation, is that the research that has gone on into birth control usually has to do with cancer and mm-hmm. breast cancer in mm-hmm. particular. But you're saying that there is evidence that taking oral birth control can contribute to this.
And again, sometimes not in isolation, but a composite of factors, as in Lucy's case. So it may not be one thing, but a mixture. But yes, birth control pills are associated with increased clotting risk. And there are different ways that increased clotting risk can then lead to a stroke.
Mm-hmm. And it's particularly true if patients smoke as well. So the combination of smoking and birth control pills, bad combination.
Smoke, every time we talk about a medical issue, I think that the doctors, mm-hmm. the very first thing they say is don't smoke. Dr. Cockcroft, what is a stroke?
So the two main types of stroke, what we're really talking about here are ischemic strokes. That's where a blood vessel to the brain becomes blocked. And the tissue that blood vessel supplies no longer functions. It ceases to work. The other type of stroke is a hemorrhagic stroke, or that's a bleeding stroke where a blood vessel bursts. And those are caused typically by aneurysms or blood vessel malformations. But what we're mainly talking about here, and that what constitutes about 80% or more of strokes, are the ischemic strokes, blood vessel blockage strokes.
And what causes it?
Well, there are a variety of causes. The most common causes are where a clot travels from somewhere else. So a clot travels from the heart, a clot travels from the arteries in the neck, goes to the brain and blocks an artery. You can also have strokes where there's disease in the artery itself, such as in the heart, where there's atherosclerosis or clot plaque buildup in the arteries of the brain, and that causes a clot to form there too.
You know, when we go to the doctor, very often we're asked about our medical history, and one of the main questions is heart disease in the family. I have to admit that I don't think of stroke as heart disease. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm usually thinking about heart attacks or other type of heart disease. Stroke is a heart disease, correct?
Well, heart is a vascular disease. So if you have heart disease in your family, then there's a good chance that you'll have stroke in your family as well, because it's a similar sort of blood vessel disease, same as peripheral vascular disease, where you have problems with the blood vessels going to the legs. And all of these are related to diet, lack of exercise, smoking, those all the same risk factors.
Mm-hmm. Lucy, your daughter, your family, mm-hmm. any history of heart disease in family?
We do. We have that history. But again, you know, you have a young adult and you're not, you know, you're doing preventative things, of course, but you never dream a stroke is going to hit you, even though a stroke occurs like once every 40 seconds, I believe it is. So, I mean, think about that. Once every 40 seconds, somebody's having a stroke. It hit our family. You know, Lucy's sister, Lauren, right away, we went to her and, you know, she had migraines and we had discussions with her as well. And, you know, she was very concerned, my husband, all of us, because here it is. And you begin talking to your family, your extended family, and then you want to talk to all your friends and everyone and let them know, you know, what are these risk factors? What's your lifestyle? But more importantly, because in our case, it just tragically hit, out of the blue. What do you do if it does hit?
And we'll talk about all those things in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. On this portion of today's program, we're talking about strokes. Our guests, Dr. Raymond Reichwein and Dr. Kevin Cockroft, they're co-directors of Penn State Hershey's Stroke Center. Also, Lucy Nazzo, her 26-year-old daughter, 26 at the time, suffered a stroke last year. We welcome your questions and comments. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can send a question or a comment to WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Reichwein, 80%, I've seen this figure or heard this figure, that 80% of strokes, by the way, is that plural or stroke? I've been referring to strokes. Okay. 80% of strokes are preventable. That's a surprising figure.
And everybody should address the risk at all ages, even if they think they're otherwise healthy. It turns out a number of people have risk if you go looking beyond just family risk, and particularly blood pressure. You can feel fine. Your blood pressure can be elevated, and unless you check, you're not going to know. But if you can address several of the common risk factors, there's recent literature that upwards of 80% or more strokes are preventable. Those include high blood pressure, which is probably number one in the list. The recent normal is less than 120 over 80. That's the official normal. There is risk with numbers higher than that. High cholesterol, borderline diabetes, as well as overt diabetes. Smoking, alcoholism speak for themselves. But also the two other big ones are carotid artery disease or blockages in the larger arteries in the neck, a very high risk for a subsequent stroke. And then lastly, with advancing age and irregular heart rhythm, known as atrial fibrillation, is one of the very common causes of a stroke in the 80s when somebody's 80 years or older and extremely disabling. But if you can address those risks, and as we talked earlier, with younger patients, addressing birth control pills, migraine with ARA, certain medications, you can dramatically alter it. And I always say, strokes are disabling. They change your life and the lives of people around you within seconds. And the number one thing is still not to have the stroke in the first place, if you can do so.
When you say address birth control, and I just want to clarify here, do you actually tell patients not to take oral contraceptives?
Or at least discuss the pros and the cons. So there's a pro and a con to everything. And if one is higher risk, I advocate trying to stay away from that and consider alternative measures. For a number of women of childbearing age, I will talk to them about considering low-dose aspirin therapy to offset some of the risk. So it needs to be an open discussion and at least low-dose aspirin therapy for many and or perhaps not using it in some very high-risk individuals.
As we're discussing this, and Lucy has mentioned it several times, speed of treatment, getting to the hospital is one of the keys to survival. Dr. Cockroft, why? Why is that so important?
Well, really, the sooner you get to the hospital, the more options you're going to have for intervention, for treatment. If you can get to the hospital and get treated within 3, maybe even within 4.5 hours, you can get an intravenous clot buster, which is basically a drug just given through a vein, can break up and dissolve the clot and improve your chances of a good outcome. If you get outside of that time window, then we're looking at more invasive procedures. We're talking about catheter procedures where we place a catheter in a blood vessel, go up into the brain, and try and pull out blood clot. And there's recent studies that suggest that we can do those procedures up to 24 hours in certain people. But these are a very small percentage of people that are going to be eligible for those kind of procedures. So your best option still is to get in as soon as possible. Because even if the drug can be given at 3 hours, that doesn't mean you can show up at 2 hours and 55 minutes. You've got to be there early because you've got to get a lot of other studies.
So speed is of the essence.
And the earlier you get treated, the more likely you are to have a good outcome.
And Scott, what I always am out there saying, I mean, time loss is brain loss. If you can remember that. So it is just an urgent call to action. Don't wait around. Am I having a stroke or is my, you know, dad having a stroke or neighbor? Call 911.
And you can lose a million brain cells per minute. There's some literature out there. So just imagine that millions of brain cells are dying within minutes of that insult. So again, it drives home that time is brain and essential quicker treatment to better outcome.
You explained what a stroke is, but what you just said is key, that there are actually are brain cells that die, and depending on the part of the brain that is affected, that's what part of the body it will have an impact, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And we've emphasized the idea of BFAST, the acronym, to try and remind you what the symptoms are and to remind you to get into the hospital quickly. So it used to just be FAST. Now it's BFAST. So B is for balance, if you have problems with your balance or coordination. E is for eyesight, so difficulty with your eyesight, double vision. F is for facial weakness. A is for arm weakness, and you can throw in leg as well. And the S is for speech. So problems with your speech, understanding, or getting your speech out. And then T is for time, reminding you to get into the hospital as soon as possible. Because again, the sooner you get in, the more interventions that are going to be available to you, and the more likely you are to have a good outcome.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from John in Lancaster. John, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, John.
I'll be celebrating the 4th anniversary of the stroke on Monday. I had a hemorrhagic stroke late in the day when I lost my balance and fell. I had no idea that I was having a stroke, but my housemate insisted that I was. And she called 911, and EMTs showed up in just minutes. They were there within 10 minutes. And I was in the ER in Lancaster, in Lancaster General, within 25 minutes. And, well, they all saved my life. I had no idea what was going on. I wasn't aware of the symptoms of stroke. I should say that a month before I had my stroke, I was admitted to the hospital diagnosed with heart failure. My heart was enlarged, and my ejection fraction was down to 22%, I believe.
Hey, John, when you say celebrating the 4th anniversary of the stroke, I doubt you're celebrating the stroke, but the 4th anniversary of your recovery, right?
Well, my recovery is ongoing. I'm not recovered entirely yet, Scott. Uh-huh. I'm almost there.
Okay.
There are some lingering effects from the stroke that are annoying and uncomfortable, but by and large, I am recovered. I can do just about everything that I could do before I had my stroke. But you're right. Yes, celebrating being alive 4 years after my stroke.
Hey, John, thank you very much for calling in, and congratulations on your recovery and good luck. But, you know, he makes a point, and hearing Lucy's story, her daughter's story, hearing John's story, we have a number of other people out there. We have an email that says, when my son was 5 years old, he suffered a stroke. Mm-hmm. He briefly lost his ability to walk and talk after about a year of speech, occupational therapy, and other therapy. He's fully recovered. He spent several weeks at Hershey Medical Center and was later evaluated by CHOPS, pediatric stroke problem. He's almost 16 years old. Till this day, we still don't know what caused it. A five-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And again, there are different causes in younger individuals, and probably three of the common causes in young people that you wouldn't know about necessarily is when you have trauma, you can tear the blood vessel, something called a dissection. A number of younger kids can have a mild clotting disorder that they don't know they have. And the third thing is congenital heart disease. Those are probably the three tops. But again, you can be asymptomatic before something goes wrong, and that's the humbling part of the business.
Hmm. You know, something that John mentioned that I think is one of the keys and one of the reasons we wanted to do this program today is that he said he didn't recognize the symptoms, that he had a friend telling him, you know, get to the hospital. But I'm a little bit surprised that there are people out there that don't recognize the symptoms, because usually, or well, maybe I should put it this way. From what you described, not all stroke symptoms are the same.
Correct.
So unless there's maybe a speech problem or, you know, a part of the arm or the drooping face or something like the facial muscles, that people may not think of it as a stroke. But why is it that there are so many people who don't recognize that they are having a stroke or someone else is having a stroke?
I think one of the theories you've had is that it doesn't hurt. So, you know, a heart attack hurts. You have chest pain, it's painful, you want to go to the hospital, you want somebody to fix it. Strokes don't hurt. So we have a lot of times we'll have the story, oh, my arm is weak, I just went to bed, I thought it would get better in the morning. And that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. So we've changed the nomenclature to say, well, this isn't a stroke now, it's a brain attack. trying to convince people it's the same thing as a heart attack, same kind of urgency.
And I'm so thankful that you've changed the acronym to BFAST, because Lucy had every single one of those symptoms. By adding balance, by adding eyes, and, you know, face, arms, legs, speech, and time. So I can't stress that enough. And one of our goals collectively here, and also as a mom on a mission in our family, is to get colleagues, coworkers, the public, medical professionals, friends, sisters, brothers, dads, moms, you name it, aware of what those symptoms are. Because oftentimes you hear about somebody even making a call, hey, I have this or that going on, I'm not sure. Oh, I'm going to see how I'm doing. You know, no, get in that car or call 911, get them to a hospital, rule it out, because you see how devastating this is. I mean, clearly, there are so many stroke survivors out there, and I want to give a big shout out to them, because we all celebrate life, and there's so much you can do through hard work, treatments, and therapy. But if we could just continue to create greater and greater awareness, I think we would be able to turn the tide a little bit more.
Absolutely. Just to follow up on that, Sherry in Lewistown called in to say that her best friend had a stroke at age 30, was not diagnosed, and died at age 30. People need to be aware of the symptoms. And so that's a point that we keep hammering
and
home here.
If I can make one comment, the IV clot buster is one of the mainstays for stroke. Only about 1 in 3 people get that, and the main reason they don't get it is they don't get to the hospital in a timely fashion. It has to be given within 3 to 4.5 hours from the onset of the symptoms, but it's humbling still in today's time. Only about 1 in 3 get it. Many more would be eligible for it if they knew it was available and they sought medical attention quickly.
Hershey, Penn State Hershey Medical Center, is a comprehensive stroke center. The two of you are directors of that center. There are some procedures that you can do that a regular hospital can't. Now, I'm not here to make a commercial for Hershey, but a couple questions along those lines. How is Hershey different, a comprehensive stroke center different than a, you know, just a regular hospital that treats everything that for people to come in? Let's start with that question.
Sure. So one of the main differences you kind of alluded to is the procedure, or are the procedures, and those are procedures that we do for acute stroke or ischemic stroke, the blood vessel blockage kind of strokes, where we can go in with a catheter, take a catheter in through the arteries up to the brain, and use devices to retrieve or pull out the clot that's causing the stroke. These are for only a small subset of a small group of patients with strokes that have large blood vessels blocked, but it can be a major game changer in terms of improving their quality of life and their recovery. So that's one of the things you can do at a comprehensive stroke center that you wouldn't see typically at a primary stroke center. And then there's a lot of other things that go into this. There's research, there's the programs just to do even dealing with the intravenous drug, the TPA, that we manage at Comprehensive Stroke Center more comprehensively. Right?
Why can't all hospitals do that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with hiring personnel, the availability of people to do this, availability of the infrastructure that goes along with doing these procedures can be difficult to maintain and costly to maintain at every hospital.
So someone has a stroke, you call 911, ambulance comes, there's a hospital that's closer than, say, Hershey. You don't want someone, that person doesn't want, or the person that's with them doesn't want to say, bypass this other hospital and get to Hershey.
Well, so this is a controversial topic nationally right now. We're trying to decide what's the best thing to do. If you're having a stroke and you're very early, then the best drug for you, or the best intervention for you, is the intravenous drug, the IV TPA. So getting to your closest hospital within that 3-hour window and getting that drug, that's the best thing to do. However, if there are suggestions that you might have what we call a large blood vessel stroke or a large vessel occlusion, those are the major strokes where a blood vessel inside the brain, a large blood vessel is blocked, then you may be better off going to the Comprehensive Stroke Center directly, because we know that just getting that drug alone is not going to improve your outcome as well as getting a catheter procedure. So that's what things are being struggled with. And there are tools out there that EMS are using to try and figure out who these large blood vessel occlusion patients are, and then using those tools to decide to take them directly to a Comprehensive Stroke Center.
Yeah, who makes that decision? I mean, that's a tough decision to make when you're talking about time being so important. That I have a hospital that's 5 miles from me, and Hershey's or another comprehensive stroke center is 15 miles from me. I would think I'd want to go where I'm going to be treated first.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're also looking at is using a telestroke or teleradiology to be able to help people make decisions or giving the clot-busting drug at some of these smaller rural hospitals. So if you are not close to a comprehensive stroke center, you can still go to a primary stroke center or even a hospital that's not a stroke center and get advice and help from people like Penn State Hershey's telestroke program to help you make a decision to give IV tPA for patients there.
Is it better to call an ambulance, or if someone is there to drive someone suffering a stroke? I've thought about this many times, with relatives and everything else. Or do we call an ambulance, or do we just have someone drive?
911 is your best friend. With an EMS system, they can call ahead to the hospital and let you know they're bringing in a suspected stroke patient. Many hospitals, essentially all stroke centers, have a stroke alert system, so a whole team of individuals can meet the patient within minutes of arrival. And knowing how busy ED waiting rooms are and triage areas, you don't want to get caught in the waiting room by accident, but I would all advocate for EMS to get you there to provide the best care.
Do stroke lead to dementia or other brain-related issues?
So there is more recent literature that even if you recover completely from your stroke at a younger age, you are at higher risk with normal aging to develop cognitive deficits later in life, to include a dementia. Also, if you have a bunch of risk factors for stroke and they're poorly modified, you hear patients out there getting brain scans done and having a bunch of silent strokes they didn't know they had. That's generally related to uncontrolled risk factors, particularly high blood pressure. Those are associated with dementia, particularly what's called vascular dementia, which is the second most common dementia behind Alzheimer's disease.
Let's take a phone call from Dave in Lemoyne. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I haven't had a stroke, but I've had a TDI or something
TIA.
Like that, mini stroke. And I wondered, I've had taken statins from time to time. I have high cholesterol. I tend to have high cholesterol, although I exercise regularly, and I'm my body weight is very good, and I don't eat a lot of fat. But I don't do well with the statins because they give me and I wondered if what you think about that situation and how important you think using statins are in stopping strokes from happening.
Okay, now we kind of lost you. You say what was the side effect that the statin caused?
Muscle cramps.
Okay, all right. Okay, we missed you when you said that. Thank you very much for your call.
Well, you bring up 2 points. The first is a mini stroke, which we didn't talk about thus far, is a very high-risk entity to go on to a stroke. The symptoms are the same. They're just transient. They go away. And if you don't tell a doctor or healthcare personnel, it may go undiagnosed. But it carries with it extremely high risk to a subsequent stroke. Some people would quote about a 1 in 5 risk or 20% risk at 90 days after the index event. So, again, if you have symptoms, you should always tell somebody if they are consistent with a mini stroke or a transient ischemic attack, a TIA, you should have appropriate testing done, medication changes done, so you don't go on to a genuine stroke. Only about 25% of people are lucky enough to have a mini stroke, but a great window of opportunity to prevent something devastating. The second question is related to the side effects of cholesterol medicines, and your point is well taken. A modest number of people do get muscle aches, pains, myalgias related to the statins. The water-soluble ones, particularly Provacol and rosuvastatin, are better tolerated, may be less likely to have that. Some people take coenzyme Q10, which can offset some of the muscle cramps. There's one other agent on the market that is long-acting that may not, and there's also some newer medications out there. But the point being is if your mini stroke was felt to be due to cholesterol deposits in a large or a small blood vessel, the statins are very critical and have about a 25% chance of reducing a subsequent stroke. So I am an advocate to always try and keep one on board if doable. Even a lower dose is probably better than none. So the other thing is if you have muscle cramps, more so at a higher dose, if you could stay on a lower dose, that's still valuable. And lastly, there are some other newer things on the market for the people that can't take the standard statins.
Real quick, aspirin.
Yep.
What about aspirin? I mean, a lot of people take aspirin for heart disease. Yep. People always say heart attacks, but
so I would say if in the standard population, you're perfectly healthy, you don't have any risk, that's where aspirin is a little controversial. But for anybody that has any risk factor that we've talked about thus far, the common risk factors, a low-dose aspirin based on more recent literature is felt to be safe, and more so in a higher-risk population, clearly can reduce stroke risk.
Had an email here. Any thought to allowing broader availability to the medicine the specialist referred to as IV Clotbuster?
Well, so the medication is quite widely available. The problem, as Dr. Reichwein pointed out, is that patients don't get to the hospital in time enough to be eligible to get it. That's usually the problem. And as we also talked about, we're trying to take steps to make it more widely available by using telemedicine to kind of leverage the expertise at larger centers, primary and comprehensive stroke centers, get that expertise into the smaller community hospitals.
We had a question from Jim, Lucy, for you. Why didn't the hospital check for stroke right away?
I'd love to know that. All I can say is be an advocate, and if you do suffer a stroke, as in our situation with our beautiful daughter, don't ever give up hope and just keep forging ahead. Lots of love.
Lucy Nazzo, Dr. Raymond Reichwein, Dr. Kevin Cockcroft, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Today's program is part of WITF's Transforming Health Project. To learn more about stroke, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, From Policy to Personal Choices. We're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. As basketball fans eagerly anticipate March Madness, much attention is now focused on allegations of recruiting improprieties that implicate some of the nation's most esteemed programs. An FBI investigation alleges loans and payments for entertainment and travel expenses for prospects and their families. A former Penn State player is one of the players alleged to have received a loan from an agent at the center of the investigation. Joining us today to discuss what's going on is Dr. Gregory Callis. He's an author and visiting assistant professor of interdisciplinary studies at Towson University. And we've had Dr. Callis on our program before when he was on the faculty at Dickinson College. Dr. Callis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Great to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, like to join this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. All right, so when I first heard about this, Yahoo Sports reported this, that the FBI was making an investigation into these allegations. They're wide-ranging, and they do involve schools like Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina, just a host of schools across the country that are considered traditionally some of the powerhouse programs in college basketball. So I thought to myself, you know, just from what I'm reading here, this could have potential to be one of the largest scandals in the history of college sports.
It could. And that's the shocking thing about it, I think, is that it did implicate so many schools, so many people. We should be clear, though, that there's varying degrees of what's been implicated. So, and part of the reporting on this has not been great.
I have to admit that, too, because I have questions about what is a payment, what is a loan, and we'll talk about those things.
Yeah. So, but it is, you know, I think it's a big deal because it finally shed light on what a lot of people knew, which was that there's lots of money floating around in ways that are technically against the rules. And finally, this has come to light. And it came to light because of an FBI investigation that started with exposing four assistant coaches who were trying to make connections with shoe companies to funnel money to players, prospective recruits. And then recently, that was back in September. And then recently this month, some more information came out from Yahoo Sports where they had access to some of the expense reports for one agent or a runner for one agent, an agent named Andy Miller and his runner called Chris Hawkins. There are lots of schools involved. What each school was accused of doing is a little bit different, though.
So just so we can provide some background here, college athletes are amateurs.
That's right. And this is, you know, if I had a big issue, big takeaway I want people to understand here, it's The problem from my perspective is not that there are people making money, not that there's people, that there are bad guys out there trying to get money to players, or that players are bad for taking money. I think the big problem is that the NCAA insists that college athletes are amateurs, that they are quote-unquote student athletes, and as such are ineligible to get any kind of payment beyond the scholarship that their school arranges for them. And it's crazy to think of college athletes, especially in men's basketball and football, as amateurs, because the amount of money that flows in, it's in the billions of dollars because of these sports, the television contracts, the tickets, the merchandising, all of that stuff. But the NCAA insists that they're amateurs, and there is the heart of the problem. You have lots of money, huge amounts of money flowing into these sports, and players who are largely unable to access that money. Now, I understand that they get a scholarship, and that's worth a whole lot these days.
$25,000, $30,000, depending on the school.
Absolutely.
A year,
and that's a lot of money. But when you look at, you know, a story came out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, showing the highest paid coaches in men's college basketball. You know, Mike Krzyzewski's making, I think, $9 million this year. The people who are earning him that $9 million are getting, you know, $50,000, you know, as far as the players go. It's just a whole mess. And I think that's, when you step back, and especially when you step back and look at the history of where the amateur idea came from, where the student athlete came from, it raises all sorts of problems.
When you say $50,000, you're referring to the scholarship.
The scholarship,
right?
Because they're
legally are not supposed to be any cash payments. So
right.
Just, again, to clarify what is being accused here or alleged here is that there were a lot, including I mentioned the one Penn State player, DJ Newbill, that either got loans or actually there are allegations that there were payments made.
Right.
Sean Miller, basketball coach, University of Arizona last week, was suspended because the FBI had him, his phone tapped, where he talked about making a $100,000 payment to a player. So, you know, what exactly are the allegations here?
So, right. So for the most part, what we've seen, the allegations are that runners for agents were, when I say a runner, sort of an employee for an agent, would make some deals on the side with a player or with his family, often giving loans to those players or giving them small favors, taking them out to meals, to make arrangements so that when that player went pro, they would be likely to sign with that agent. So that's one segment of it. And that's where DJ Newbill comes in, for example. And I think his loan was either $1,000 or $2,000, something like
$2,000.
Yeah. So not a huge amount. Some of those loan numbers were bigger. There's a guy at NC State who I think it was more than $40,000, Dennis Smith. So that's the one. And then the other side, you do have this alleged wiretap of Sean Miller, where he was making arrangements to actually pay somebody $100,000 so that they would come to play for Arizona. And that player, DeAndre Boynton, is playing for Arizona, is playing very well. He did return to coach just the other day. He's adamant that he's done nothing wrong. So everybody's denying everything by and large. But it's also been clear to me, I've been following this stuff for years now, and it's been clear that there is money going on, that there's money been changing hands, and that agents and shoe companies in particular have been involved in this. You'd hear stories of, well, this recruit's not going to sign with that school because he's on an Adidas AAU program, and that school's a Nike school, so he's not going to go there. Well, that shouldn't matter at all unless there's money being exchanged here. And that kind of stuff was widespread. So we're finally getting a window into this and exposing how a lot of the stuff works.
We've talked before on this program,
yeah,
in fact, about the exploitation of athletes. You feel that there have been athletes exploited, many times players who are of color, black players. And you are of the opinion that players should be paid.
I am of the opinion that players should not be denied the opportunity to make money. And what I mean by that is I don't think the schools should pay them, because the schools do pay them in the form of
a scholarship right,
and room and board, and these are good scholarships. But I think the crazy thing for me is, you know, if you take an example like a few years ago, Johnny Manziel, college football player, in the offseason was at an event and was apparently charging money to sign autographs for people. Johnny Manziel was not wearing anything related to the university. He was in his own free time. The NCAA caught wind of that and punished him, because they said it's illegal for him to make money by selling his autograph. What right does the NCAA have to prevent somebody in their spare time from making money? If somebody wants to pay these players, if they want to give them money to, I mean, why not? Let's say you own a car dealership, Scott. Let's pretend. And you say, I'm going to have Saquon Barkley, back when he was still playing at Penn State. I'd like to put him up on a billboard saying, when I drive, I want to drive a Scott Lamar Ford. If he's not wearing Penn State regalia, if he's not doing anything about the university, why should he not be allowed to accept your money? So my point is not, again, that the school should pay. It's that the NCAA has to get out of the business of telling people what that they can or cannot make money in their own time.
The argument against it, and there would be a few, but one would be competitive advantages, that some schools could afford to pay, find jobs, whatever, could come up with more money than other schools. And those schools that have more money, that the, you know, whenever there's money involved and there's competitive edge being accused, that it could be ripe for scandal. It could be ripe for, you know, it's funny we're saying that, but you know what I'm saying is
sure,
that
sure.
That it would give, and the NCAA is all about this, supposedly about this competitive advantage thing.
I think there's two things I would say to that. One is, okay, fine, if we acknowledge that, we could set a limit and say, okay, you're allowed to earn X amount of dollars in a year. We'll give you a sort of a quota that you're allowed to earn, and then every school would be at the same tier, right? So again, the schools wouldn't be providing the money, but we would say you could only make a certain amount. We could figure out what that number is. That's one solution. You say, well, if you do that, then people are just going to find ways to make money beyond that allowed. I don't know about that. You know, an analogy I've been thinking about was iTunes. Remember when the iTunes store came out and Apple said, you know, there's all this concern about downloading digital music and how no one's going to pay for digital music because they can download it illegally. And Steve Jobs said, you know what? Most people don't want to be criminals. Most people don't want to engage in illegal behavior. They've been downloading music because they can't pay for it. We're going to make it possible to pay for it. And guess what? People paid for it. The iTunes store did quite well. I think if we could make it legal for players to accept money, they wouldn't be inclined to do the illegal stuff or the stuff that's against the rules because they'd have the legal option of doing it. So that would be one answer. The other answer is, I'm less worried about schools struggling in the competitive arena if it means that some poor kids, disadvantaged kids, are able to help themselves and their families. That seems like a moral trade-off I'm willing to make.
You bring up a big point there because many times in the money-making sports, men's college basketball and football, many of these players come from backgrounds where they don't have a lot of resources. There's not a lot of money in the home. They're, you know, maybe living in areas of that are very poor to begin with. It's very difficult for them to get out of that. So I have to think that's one of the reasons that we have one of them done in college basketball now, that you have a player go from high school, play 1 year in college basketball, and then turn pro because they're looking for the money. But what about that? I mean, how much of, because many of these kids that are caught up in this do come from humble backgrounds, come from backgrounds where there's not a lot of money in the family.
Yeah, and I heard Carlos Boozer talking about this. He was interviewed. Carlos Boozer, former Duke basketball
right.
player,
mm-hmm.
former NBA pro. And he said, look, you know, to be honest, he said, most of us come from these poorer backgrounds. We don't have a whole lot of money. And I was struck by how modest his sort of hopes were for this. You know, he didn't talk about driving the Escalade. I'm so on hip. I don't know what the big cool car is these days. But anyway, he wasn't talking about that. Right? He said, you know, what would have been nice when I was at Duke is if I could have had some extra money so that I could, you know, not eat at the cafeteria every once in a while. Because that's what I could afford, right? My scholarship paid for the cafeteria, but if I wanted to go out, I didn't have the money to do that. He didn't have the money to buy those little extra things. And that's a pretty modest thing, right? But he came from a disadvantaged background. He didn't have that. He saw other players, you know, in that same boat. And so, you know, I think that's one thing to think about.
Joe Paterno used to, the former Penn State coach, used to say that there should be an allowance for players. Now, he didn't call it a payment. Mm-hmm. He said if a player needed to buy a shirt, needed to buy a tie or a jacket to go to a banquet or something like that, that player should have some money because they come from this poor background. Their families can't afford that many times. We only have about 15 seconds left. What do you want to see happen in 15 seconds?
I want to see the NCAA recognize that student athletes are not just students who happen to play a sport, that they occupy a distinct place in the university campus with distinct responsibilities, and we should therefore treat them differently.
Dr. Gregory Callis with Towson University, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Monday's program, we're going to be talking about an increase in anti-Semitic incidents in Pennsylvania. And also, WITS Brett Schultes rides along with an ambulance crew that revives an overdose victim. And really quite a story. That's coming up on Monday's program on Monday Smart Talk.